This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the aftermath of the passage of House Bill 2, the fallout seemed minimal to most. There were some canceled concerts. A few businesses that we know about changed their minds on relocating to North Carolina. But it was with sports and sporting events that the consequences of this bill have really been felt. First, Charlotte was stung by the NBA pulling their All-Star weekend. But last week, both the NCAA and the ACC decided to withdraw a series of championship games from around the state, including this year's ACC championship football game scheduled in December for Bank of America Stadium. It's in revenues connected to sports. In Charlotte alone, the tab has climbed to $100 million. This sudden support of the LGBT community by the macho world of collegiate and professional sports may seem an unlikely pairing, but social issues and activism have long been part of the fabric of sports, going back to Jackie Robinson's breaking of baseball's color barrier in April of 1947 to today's national anthem protests in the NFL. Is this support of LGBT rights by sports just the natural extension of that activist tradition? We spend the hour looking at that with Dr. Daniel Grano, associate professor in the Department of Communications at UNC Charlotte, whose research includes the study of how power shapes moral judgment in popular cultural contexts. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Grano's in our studio, and joining us by phone is Ashlyn Johnson, Director of Policy and Campaigns for Athlete Ally, which provides public awareness campaigns and educational programming to foster inclusive sports communities. They are a close partner of the NBA on player development and LGBT inclusion. They work with the NFL Players Association, and Ashlyn has been spearheading the organization's work with the NCAA. She joins us by phone from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
And joining us from the studios of WUNC in Durham is Luke DeCock, sports columnist with the Raleigh News and Observer. Thank you for joining us, Luke.
Thank you very much for having me. You're welcome.
Did it surprise any of you that aside from the occasional musical artist and a few companies, that the biggest negative reaction to HB2 has come from the world of sports? And let me begin with our sports columnist, who has supposedly no dog in this race. Did it surprise you, Luke?
No, it didn't, and for a couple of reasons. I think, one, if you look at the NBA and their initial decision to pull the All-Star game out of Charlotte, you know, their concern was over whether North Carolina under HB2 was a community that was welcoming to any of its constituents, whether they be players or staff members or sponsors or whatever, who within the LGBT community. And you know, the NCAA for a long time has had a history of not taking its championships to places where its constituents might not feel welcome. And that would extend to the ban against South Carolina and Mississippi hosting NCAA neutral site championships that because of the Confederate flag. And that's something that was only recently lifted in the case of South Carolina. And the ACC certainly, if you look at its history, I wrote last week about the 1983 golf tournament in Rocky Mount, which was held at a course that did not, a private club that did not admit black members. And the ACC, including John Swofford, who's the commissioner now and was the athletic director at North Carolina then, was insistent that the holding it at that course was not consistent with the ACC's values. So there's a long history of this, as you mentioned earlier, but you know, there's sort of two currents here. One is the ability with the visibility and economic force that sports commands to advocate for change. And also the fact that they don't want to be hosting their events in a state where their people may not feel welcome. And I think that's, regardless of politics, the national impression of HB2 has been that North Carolina is not a state where the LGBT community is welcome or treated fairly because of HB2. And I think that inevitably would have its impact on sports. The NBA was obviously the first to act, but at that point I think it did become inevitable that the NCAA and ACC would act. In fact, the NCAA laid this out very clearly at the Final Four. It was actually in March, before the games were played. But when we got to Houston, that if there wasn't a change in North Carolina, that the NCAA would act. And you know, it took all summer, and they waited and waited for something to happen. Nothing did, and the NCAA acted, and the ACC followed suit.
Well, the initial reaction to this HB2 being passed was swift from certain businesses like PayPal and some artists who decided to cancel concerts, and Stephen Schwartz, who has forbidden any of his Broadway musicals to be performed by any organization within the state of North Carolina, as long as this bill is on the books. But it took a little longer for sports to react, or so it seemed. It took a while for the NBA to pull the All-Star weekend from Charlotte. It took longer for the NCAA. It took even longer for the ACC to take action. Ashland, how do you explain that?
For organizations like the NCAA and the ACC, they operate differently than, let's say, the NBA, because they have their member schools. So what the NCAA had to do is initially they had to put into place a new bidding process. And that new bidding process had kind of factors that would determine where they would place their games and whether or not those games were LGBT consistent with LGBT values. They did that probably 2 months after HB2 was passed, and then 2 months later they came out with a survey. And then you're right, last week they finally announced that based off of what those survey results are going to say, they will never have the event in North Carolina. There's still outstanding questions about whether or not they'll have events in states with other negative LGBT laws, but they've resolved that issue. ACC, same thing. They have member schools that they have to appease. And these member schools are in different states with different laws, with different cultures. So it's a little harder for them to make that decision about whether or not they're going to move all of the tournament events because they need a different type of consensus. When it came to the NBA, they were trying to work with members in Charlotte, in North Carolina, for a very long time because they actually had a team based there. So their logic was, well, we'll always have a franchise there, so we need to figure out how do we work with the community and actually do positive things for the LGBT community and maybe not have to move this game. And the compromise they wanted, it didn't happen. And so we are happy that they had no choice at this point and they followed through and actually moved the game.
So you look at the intersection of sports and religion and moral ethics and moral judgment, Dr. Grano. This sounds like a business decision that these leagues or these sports organizations made, more than a moral decision, or maybe a hybrid of that in some way with a 60-40 split or something like that. How do you see it?
I do see it as a hybrid decision. I think it's partly a business decision. I think that these organizations recognize that to be a viable and sustainable 21st century commercial enterprise, you can't have a perception that you embrace or tolerate homophobic or transphobic policies and values. At the same time, sport disproportionately historically draws from relatively politically conservative population, trades on a lot of hyper-masculine values, and so there are likely calculations that play into maintaining, to use a loose term, traditional sporting audiences, while also looking forward to what those audiences are going to be composed of moving forward.
So we had the cancellation of several companies moving here. We had cancellations of concerts. But it wasn't until sports came along and decided we're pulling the All-Star game, we're pulling the all these NCAA playoff games, championship games, we're pulling the ACC championship games, et cetera, from North Carolina because of HB2. That's when people started to listen. That's when those who dug in their heels, who are in favor of HB2, finally said, okay, well, perhaps we can reach some sort of a compromise here. Is it simply the economics of these events being pulled from the state of North Carolina, or is there something about the psyche of the fans that comes into play here, Luke?
Well, I think it has more to do with the culture of North Carolina itself. And I think economically speaking, you know, some of the other negative impacts of HB2 have probably had a bigger economic impact. But, you know, when we think of ourselves as North Carolinians, when we think of North Carolina as a state, you know, there are certain elements that help define what that means, especially in an era when there's a tremendous amount of migration. You know, I would say that the two that trump everything else are probably basketball and barbecue. And I've written this several times, but, you know, that those were the two things that you could agree upon in the state, regardless of partisan political affiliation, and now we're down to barbecue. So when you start pulling sports, which, you know, at every level, youth sports, high school sports, college sports, professional sports, it's true in almost any state, I think. But it's especially true here because of the strong ties with the universities and the history of college basketball and what that has meant to this state. That when you start messing with that, you know, you're really messing with people. They may not feel an immediate impact on their pocketbook because PayPal has pulled out of its expansion, but they will feel it if they were planning to go to Greensboro to watch North Carolina play in the NCAA
tournament. But surely the legislature, because a lot of this is, all the universities are congregated around the state house. They're up in your part of the woods, your neck of the woods. Surely the legislature saw this coming. Surely.
I can't speak to that. You know, I'm obviously, my expertise is not in politics and North Carolina politics and all of that. You know, all I can say is, through all of these negative impacts, through PayPal and Pearl Jam and Springsteen, you know, these have all been things where you kind of shake your head. But I do think the one thing that any politician can't mess with when it comes to his constituents, his or her constituents, whether they be a Republican or a Democrat or whatever, is I think in North Carolina, you just don't mess with basketball, period. And that's when the calls start coming in, and that's when the emails start coming in, and that's when you start to say, well, hold on a second here, let's reconsider this.
You have a book, Dr. Grana, that's either just come out or is about to come out. I'm not clear on exactly what the timeline is, on sports, religion, and politics. And back in the days of the civil rights struggle, there were several religious denominations who ended up being on the wrong side of that struggle. And even though Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947, in baseball, they continued to be on the wrong side of that struggle for a significant amount of time. Is this another example, what's going on with LGBT rights and transgender rights, is this another example of sports being a force for change and one that may make some religious denominations rethink things later on down the road?
Well, it's possible, but let's go with the Jackie Robinson example, which is a very standard way of thinking about these things. Jackie Robinson's breaking of the color barrier was always conditional. He broke the color barrier in a way that was more or less acceptable to the existing white fan base of baseball. And to the extent that HB2 represents the unification of the desires of sports organizations to do well into the 21st century and LGBT rights, it's still going to be under specific conditions. A lot of folks who are writing about the NCAA, for example, coming out against HB2 are also pointing out that the NCAA has a very mixed record on transgender rights, including...
Doesn't all of sports?
It does. And so...
And all of sports would have a mixed record, it would seem to me, on LGBT rights.
Mixed record, but I would also use the word conditional record. That it depends on the particular ways in which these changes are occurring. This looks a lot different if it directly threatens the day-to-day operations of sport as when, for example, transgender athletes attempt to achieve competitive eligibility in a particular NCAA sport. It's a very, very different set of arguments.
Hmm. A lot of that has to do, I would think, with hormones and what that does to your physical conditioning, et cetera. How do you see this, Ashlyn? I only have 30 seconds left in this segment, but how do you see this? Is this part of a progression of sports moving the needle when it comes to social issues?
I think absolutely. I think what we have to do is think about sports as not one monolithic space, but as separate spaces, such as the athlete on the court, the fan base in the stands, and then the athletes and the fans when they leave the stands and how they are treated under the law. I think when it comes to the athlete on the field, we're doing very well for LGBT issues, but not for trans issues.
That's Ashlyn Johnson. We're coming right back with more of this discussion in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and SunTrust Bank, providing tools and information to help people take a step toward financial confidence. SunTrust Bank, member FDIC. Well, Wells Fargo has gotten itself into a bit of trouble lately, but the bank says it's been corrected and the responsible employees fired. They've also agreed to pay fines, but the CEO is heading to testify on Capitol Hill. This has put big banks back into the spotlight, ignited during the Great Recession. We're going to take a closer look at what's been going on there. But first, tomorrow, we will give you an update on the outcome of the discussion, if there is one, about tonight's Charlotte City Council decision, if there is one, about the non-discrimination ordinance and its effect on the future of HB2. We'll be following that story tonight and bring you the latest tomorrow at the top of this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, in about a week, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will make their case for the White House. A preview of the first presidential debate, what the candidates are likely to discuss, their strategies, and how the debate might affect the dynamics of the race.
Stay tuned for the Diane Rehm Show, ahead from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, on listener-supported public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the intersection of sports and LGBT and transgender rights, given the HB2 situation in North Carolina and the pulling of major games and championship series by the NCAA, the ACC, and, of course, the All-Star Weekend by the NBA. Dr. Daniel Grano is in our studio, Associate Professor of Communications at UNC Charlotte, who writes about this and does research on this area of discussion. Ashlyn Johnson, Director of Policy and Campaigns for Athlete Ally. They are an organization that works with the NBA and the NFL and the NCAA on LGBT issues. Luke Dukakis, a sports columnist for the Raleigh News and Observer. When leagues and teams and sports organizations take a stand on social issues, are they doing so out of altruism because they feel a moral obligation to take that stand? Or are they doing it because they recognize that society is moving in a particular direction and economically they can't afford to be on the sidelines? I'm not sure who to ask that question of. Luke.
I think there's a little of all of those things you mentioned. I think there's also a certain expediency involved with not wanting to be swept up in a controversy, you know, to sort of avoid it as opposed to being labeled with, you know, drawn into it. But, the ACC is an interesting case because, you know, it's an organization that was founded in North Carolina, is based in North Carolina. It's chartered, has four schools, you know, four charter members. It's a very North Carolina institution. And in some ways, this was a very courageous act to pull these events from its home state. It's a scathing, you know, sort of denouncement. Yep. By the same token, the ACC was to a certain extent slow to act in the sense that the NBA and NCAA acted first.
Ashlyn, you work behind the scenes with these organizations. How do you see the way they see this?
I think that when it comes to sports, it is an interesting institution because it's a business that kind of is accessible because people see it as something that's altruistic. So they have to maintain that balance. They don't want to just make business decisions, but they want to also keep that idea open that their values of equality and inclusion are actually there because that's what gets most people in love with the game. I think when it came to the ACC's decision, yes, they were extremely slow with making their decision because they were located in North Carolina. But most of their member schools have LGBT protections. And it's important to remember that they didn't go as far as the NCAA did. They chose to keep some of their championship games in North Carolina if they were at member schools. So when it comes to protecting most fans, they didn't do the same thing that the NCAA did. They didn't just take most of their championships out. They chose to keep them there if they were at an ACC member school. Hmm. So you still have the issue of what's going to happen when that trans fan goes to a restaurant to celebrate the game, or what's going to happen to an LGBT family when they try to get a hotel. So I think it does show that there is kind of a business dynamic there, too, because they didn't want to harm their member schools.
Hmm. I'm going to spend some time talking with Luke in this segment because we're losing him at 9:40, and I want to make sure we get some sports columnist questions out of the way before we do so. You wrote in the News and Observer, Luke, that if Pat McCrory and the North Carolina legislators who have failed to repeal or otherwise fix House Bill 2 didn't see the pullout of the NCAA coming, They just weren't paying attention. That's from your column. You think they believed that this wouldn't really happen, that this couldn't really happen?
You know, I don't know that. I think to a certain extent with HB2 and some of the pushback from every angle, from business, from entertainment, from sports, there just seems, from my perspective, to be a numbness to it on the part of the people who have supported or pushed HB2 through. And whether they believe the NCAA would act or not, it just doesn't seem like it matters to them that much. That with sort of each passing blow to North Carolina,
well, clearly it matters now because they're talking about anything more than repealing. Now they used to be talking about, well, we'll make some modifications to this law if Charlotte will repeal its ordinance. Now, if Charlotte will repeal its ordinance, they're talking about repealing HB2. It's hit home.
It has, but I still don't think that they were considering that until the NCAA acted, because so many other things had happened and we hadn't seen a response. I do think that was the power of what the NCAA did, and to an extent the ACC as well, which is to say, look, you know, you were warned, specifically in the case of the NCAA, warned months ago, just as the NBA attempted to work on some sort of compromise without success. The NCAA made it very clear what the criteria were. They were ignored. And now that the penalty is being paid, it seems like there's finally some willingness to act.
So clearly the legislature misread the tea leaves here. I know you're not a political reporter, but how can that be? How can people be astoundingly tone deaf?
That's a very good question. I think to a certain extent it actually took the shock of seeing NCAA tournament basketball games, in addition to everything else. I mean, just as football is the big one for the ACC, the basketball games in Greensboro. You know, and I'll say this about the NCAA and its action, and it actually did North Carolina a favor by pulling the games out this year and leaving 2017-18. Those events, including basketball in Charlotte, those are still in place for the moment. And there's also a bid cycle. This is going to cover every NCAA championship event other than the Final Four from 2019 to 2022. North Carolina is at risk of losing 4 years of NCAA events. So the NCAA, by saying we're taking away 16-17, they've left 17-18 in place. They've left the possibility of 19 to 22 in place, whereas it would have been very easy to say, we are going to skip you in this next bid cycle, and North Carolina would have lost 4 years. So there is a carrot and stick thing going on here. North Carolina has lost, but the possibility is still out there. If this can get fixed, North Carolina may not lose that much, whereas we get into early next year and things haven't changed. You're talking about no NCAA events through 2023.
From your point of view as a sports writer, why is this so important? Because there are a lot of people who just are scratching their heads thinking, I agree with HB2. I think we need it. Charlotte went too far. Why is this so important to sports organizations? Why?
Well, as I said earlier, that the importance of playing your games in an environment where your fans, coaches, staff, sponsors feel welcome, feel included, aren't in a position where they may feel discriminated against. You know, there are things sports does very poorly, in terms of whatever, social movements, whatever you want to call it. Sports is awkward about some things. You know, we've seen that with this anthem stuff. You've got players protesting. You've got other players protesting the players protesting. You have teams struggling how to do it. You have the coach of the U.S. team for this World Cup of Hockey saying he wouldn't play any players who protested the anthem. You know, there's been this lurching from side to side with this as people struggle how they want to deal with these protests. But on other issues, and in this case with HB2, there's been some unanimity to it. There's been a clear-cut path of action where these leagues feel like they don't want to do their business in a state, like many other businesses, or bring their athletes to a state that has a discriminatory policy. And in the case of North Carolina, when it comes to basketball or the ACC football championship, these are things that happen to be extremely important to North Carolinians. So when you start tinkering with that, people tend to get a little angry.
Is that why the ACC took so long to act? They followed it seemed like grudgingly, several days after the NCAA made their decision, the ACC stepped into this. And you've already mentioned John Swofford, who is the ACC commissioner, who in 1983 said that discrimination is a public concern and one on which the ACC should do what is right. So given his own words years ago, why was he so slow on the uptake here?
You know, I think there's definitely two sides to that. As Ashlyn mentioned earlier, the ACC is an organization that has 15 member schools in different states. You know, there's two members of the North Carolina system, along with two private schools here in the state that had sort of differing perspectives to this. Swofford is sort of herding cats a lot of the time, trying to get these groups together. They don't meet a lot. A lot of this is conducted offline, so to speak, and then when you do get the Council of Presidents together, you get immediate action. I do think, however, that Swofford's rhetoric throughout this, going back to the NCAA's sort of ultimatum in March and April, was probably a little tepid, a little weak. You know, he had the opportunity several times at the ACC spring meetings after the NBA pulled out the All-Star game in particular, because the entire ACC was in Charlotte that day for its football media weekend. So this is a very large gathering of ACC executives, administrators. Swofford is there. Football coaches are there. It's a very big ACC gathering. And, you know, the ACC just constantly punted on any attempt to show any leadership here until both the NBA and NCAA had acted. How much of that was juggling constituencies, and how much of that was sort of there was a very wait-and-see attitude among the ACC, almost like, if we wait this out, it will go away and we don't have to do anything. And yeah, that, I thought, reflected a certain lack of foresight.
Dr. Crowley, you said that you believe that we are seeing a moment of reawakening of athlete activism. We've talked about all the things the NBA, the NCAA, the ACC have been up to. Colin Kaepernick, that kind of spearheaded this movement of sitting or kneeling, taking a knee during the national anthem at NFL games. And we are seeing more athletes doing things like that all of a sudden. So are we seeing athletes supporting LGBT rights, or just their parent organizations?
Well, I think we are. You know, we're seeing activism across the board, including on LGBT rights, and in some places that we don't usually expect it. For example, the NFL. The recent protests over the national anthem and police shootings of unarmed African Americans and so on are being widely assumed as a sort of rekindling of what we feel is a foregone moment of athlete activism, especially surrounding the civil rights movement. And I think that, you know, in between, we have everybody saying, why doesn't Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan do more to use their public pulpit for social justice? And I think one of the reasons is we're in a moment of unique unrest that athletes happen to be identifying with and responding to. And I really think that this reawakening is quite real.
But why now? What's going on right now? What's happening in the zeitgeist that both we have athletes protesting the national anthem, we have the NBA pulling games because of transgender rights? What's going on now?
HB2 is a very, very clear effort to suppress the rights of LGBT persons. Police shootings are very real, material episodes of state violence. We're in a condition where these problems are so acute that to not respond would stand out as a moral failure.
And this is Ashton speaking. And as someone who's done a lot of LGBT work, the movement has done a great job with changing a rhetoric of LGBT rights being something that's a political issue to something that's being a civil rights issue. And so we're seeing this actually bleed over into what sports and what athletes are talking about when they talk about LGBT rights. That, again, it's not a political issue that sports people should sit on the sideline when it comes to. It's actually a civil rights issue that impacts athletes and players and fans.
But several people in this conversation have used the term macho world of sports, which is what it is, which traditionally has been. And that is a code word, kind of, for heterosexuality. And there have been and always have been, I assume, gay athletes playing in football games and basketball games. We just didn't know it because they feared coming out of the closet, and many still do. And we've seen some instances in recent history where football players have admitted that they're gay, and suddenly they don't play much anymore. Whether that's because they're not a good player is up to for debate, I suppose. But Ashlyn, you work behind the scenes. Has that changed? Are players in the locker room more open to having gay teammates?
I think players say they're open to having gay teammates. I would not know the numbers on that because it's something we haven't actually had a study on with a real climate study survey. But we know that leagues are putting in good policies. And in order to have good practices, you have to have good policies. So I do think this is an area where things are changing because at least people know that it's an issue that needs to be addressed because there are LGBT athletes.
And Dr. Grano has said that LGBTQ rights and organizational interests are lining up in a way they haven't before. Is that, Ashlyn, because of the work of organizations like yours?
I'm sorry, I'm not really understanding the question.
Well, the question is, Dr. Grano has said that LGBTQ rights and organizational interests are lining up in ways they haven't before, particularly in the world of sports. So is that because of organizations like yours that work behind the scenes and have these in-depth one-on-one conversations with these organizations?
Yes, there is kind of like a translation curve here because the sad truth is a lot of people in the LGBT movement have not had very good experiences with sports. So it wasn't really an avenue that was kind of like that was just that we thought they were going to be allies because usually in high school and middle school, a lot of queer people have had just bad experiences with sports. So actually having a translator where you have athlete allies, where you have athletes who are non-LGBT identified, actually reaching out and wanting to do things on LGBT rights issues has been helpful. So slowly we've seen more people sign on to our letters, lobby the NFL, lobby the NBA, lobby the NCAA in ways that we didn't see 5 years ago.
So let me turn this around. Conservative lawmakers, including our governor, say that this is part of the homosexual agenda that's being pushed or forced on people. So when you have these conversations behind the scenes with the NCAA and the NBA and the NFL, is that what this is?
No, it's more of a let's talk about our shared values. And a lot of times people have the right policies in place, but they're not interpreting them in ways that are inclusive. The NCAA has great policies. They have great gender policies. But they weren't seeing that as they needed to protect their LGBT athletes as well. So it's more so having a conversation with people and just expanding your notion of what discrimination is and what inclusion looks like. And I guess if the agenda for us is full equality, then yes, you can say that's a part of an LGBT agenda. But sports is a great realm to do that.
Dr. Grano.
It's also becoming a lot more difficult to make that blanket case that it's the homosexual agenda or whatever other categorization that the governor wants to use. And there was actually a statement, I think a very telling statement, that McCrory put out after the NBA decided to pull the All-Star game. He said that the sports and entertainment elite, Attorney General Roy Cooper, and the liberal media are representing HB2's intentions. Right. So now they find themselves positioned against a coalition that isn't so easy to define in blanket terms anymore, and probably surprises them in its rejections.
I have 40 seconds left, Luke DeCock from the News and Observer, and I know I have to let you go at 9:40, but sports columnists and journalists are speaking out against HB2. You've done it. Local columnists here have as well. Why?
Well, I think, you know, as sports columnists, we write about sports, but we also write about the intersection of sports with politics and life and society and culture. I would like to think that in any issue of civil rights or human rights, I will be on the right side in the end. And I just think when I look at HB2 that there's a clear right and wrong here, and I'm going to write it as if that's the case because that's what I believe, that's my opinion, and that's what I think is right.
Luke DeCock is a sports columnist with the Raleigh News and Observer. He joined us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. We're going to come back with Ashlee Johnson from Athlete Ally in Washington and Dr. Daniel Grano in our studio in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg Eye Associates, specializing in treatment of cataracts, glaucoma, macular degeneration, and diabetic eye diseases. With three Charlotte area locations, Mecklenburg Eye Associates, 800-628-EYES. And Nexen Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court, with regulators, and at the deal table. With offices in Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations, next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. In about a week, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will make their case for the White House, a preview of the first presidential debate, what the candidates are likely to discuss, the strategies they might employ, and how the debate might affect the dynamics of the race going toward November. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join ours, now's your time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks.
Those online fashion subscription services, clothing picked for you by a stylist, used to be big just among women, but you got to grow the market.
What's great about the company and a little bit of why we're doing it now is that we have healthy economics. We have healthy unit economics and healthy growth.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, changing the game in men's fashion, next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, talking about HB2 and sports reaction to it, and whether or not this is part of a tradition in the world of sports, of social activism, changing things like the color barrier. Dr. Daniel Grano is with us in our studio, associate professor of communication at UNC Charlotte, who studies these things. Ashlyn Johnson joins us by phone from Washington, where she is director of policy and campaigns for Athlete Ally. We invited both the ACC and the NCAA to be on the program today with us, and they could not make themselves available for our show. There's a question about the CIAA from Roderick, who emailed us. Why doesn't the CIAA take a stand against discrimination? Based on its history, I would think the organization would want to lead this type of issue. And we're told that Ronald Carter, who's president of Johnson C. Smith University, has said on Friday that there will be discussions this week about whether to move the CIAA out of Charlotte if HB2 stays on the books. Talk about that, Ashlyn, because you're African-American, you're gay, and you're in charge of this organization because you're an athlete as well. African-Americans have been slow to the table on this issue.
I'd like to push back on that, because a lot of the changes that we've seen when it comes to social justice in sports, especially for LGBT people, actually was sparked by two prominent black players coming out, Jason Collins and Brittany Griner. And since that's happened, we've seen the sports community stand up and do a lot of great things. We saw, like, the Super Bowl committee, they were going to pull out of Arizona back in 2014. In Georgia, when they tried to pass a bad religious bill, we saw the Braves, the Hawks, and the Falcons step up and actually say something. And so a lot of the leaders that we're seeing speaking out on LGBT rights are athletes of color, especially women of color. So when it comes to the athletes speaking out, I do think that there are a lot of people in the black community where we're finally seeing black faces speak on LGBT issues. When it comes to older leadership, on the other hand, like what we're seeing in leagues, they are a little slower because of different generational gaps. But that doesn't mean they're going to get there. A lot of these other leagues, like the ACC and NCAA, took months to move. I think that because the CIA hasn't done it yet, it doesn't mean that it's an issue because of the demographic running, if that makes sense.
When organizations like yours, Athlete Ally, started to work behind the scenes with the NFL Players Association and the NBA and the NCAA, mm-hmm. what kind of reaction did you get initially, and how difficult was it to advance the ball down the field with regard to your particular take on these issues?
With the NBA, it was very easy. We still do their rookie training program because a lot of coaches and franchises realize that if they want the best player possible, that player has to bring them their full selves to the court. So it becomes about winning. And whenever you can tell a coach that you can help them win, mm-hmm. and that this winning won't be a distraction, you can get into a space. Where it's become more difficult with these leagues is trying to convince them that their advocacy should go beyond the court and also into the stands, and then also into the arena of laws and equality. That's where we received most of the pushback. But after the NBA's decision to leave Charlotte, we've gotten less pushback from leagues about this.
Hmm. You said that you see sports and athletic communities at the forefront of changing hearts and minds, particularly in regions like the South. Are you saying that's what's happening, or are you hoping that that is what will happen?
I'm saying that's what is happening. It is so easy to pass negative LGBT legislation when people view those laws as something political and not personal. Sports and religion, for people in the South, we all know is extremely personal. Mm-hmm. When you mess with people's sports, it gets personal. So when people are seeing these bills pass, a lot of times they may think, oh, that's really awful, but it doesn't impact me. But when they see that there's a negative impact, such as losing their personal interest in sports, then they realize that these laws do have full implications and inclusion becomes more of a team sport. So I do think we're seeing that in the South, especially the business angle, when they realize that there's money up for grabs because these tournaments have to go somewhere and stay in the southern region.
Mm. Let me ask you this. HB2, most of the focus has been on the bathroom part of the bill, but the bill includes a lot of other things, including removing LGBT protections in places like Charlotte and a few other communities that had passed protections for LGBT citizens that do not exist at the state level, and therefore and says that nobody can have more protections than what the state already provides. Mm-hmm. But the focus has been on bathrooms. As an athlete, as somebody who works with other athletes and teams and leagues, does the idea of having a person go in, of a transgender man or a transgender woman go into a locker room to change clothes, is that uncomfortable?
It is uncomfortable for me. I just think of locker room culture and how it is in general. I know it's different between men and women's sports, but usually there are always private spaces, and none of your teammates are in there worrying about who might be staring at them or maybe who shouldn't belong in the locker room, unless you're a member of the other team. But it was never an issue when I was playing. You're more so worried about winning and more so worried about being a team than you are about policing the locker room.
What makes HB2 different from other hot button social issues? Why wasn't there this kind of reaction to, say, Amendment 1, the 2012 Marriage Amendment, for example? Why aren't leagues and organizations reacting like this in states where similar social issues have cropped up and landed on the right side of the equation rather than on the left? Why North Carolina? Why are we being singled out?
Well, North Carolina, HB2 is egregious. It also had more than just negative LGBT implication. It was bad for racial minorities, and it was bad for women. And just the way that it was done. But the fact that North Carolina is such a big sports state, that became one of our strategies. We actually could go to leagues and teams and say, here's something you can do that's tangible, that will impact your community. All you have to do is write a statement. And so when you have southern states, that's something you can do. If it's like Mississippi, it would make it a little harder to kind of lean on the leagues and teams in that particular way. But for North Carolina, if you want to impact the city, a state that wants to grow, sports is a very good way to do it.
Mm. Governor McCrory has said that the NCAA's actions are hypocritical because they kept last year's Final Four in Houston. And in Houston, their voters there overturned LGBT ordinances that provided protection. What's the difference?
Well, we would say that the difference is, one, the NCAA has not yet said that they're going to prioritize cities with positive LGBT laws. That is what our goal is, but that's not what they said they've done. But they have shown a trend of not going to cities with negative LGBT laws. So although the voters overturned a positive law, a negative law wasn't implemented. So that's what their rationale is for keeping the Final Four there. After their new survey and bidding process, we don't know if that would be the case, because venues have to show how they'll be welcoming to LGBT people, and it's kind of hard to show that you're going to be welcoming when an overwhelming majority of your people actually voted against LGBT rights. However, we would say that that's the big distinguishing marker between the two.
Before I let Luke Dukak go from the News and Observer, I mentioned that he and other sports journalists had been supportive of repealing HB2 and very much against the bill in general. And Dr. Grano, you say that sports journalism is better equipped to take on conflict and that there aren't the same institutional pressures to create false equivalencies, these are your words, false equivalencies or balance around conflict. Explain that.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing about false equivalency in its typical form would be having two people on about HB2, one for, one against, and having that presumably represent balance in your reporting. Sport journalists have, I think, a little bit more latitude in the expectation that the narratives that they advance don't necessarily have to be impartial. And I'm not saying that as a...
It's about sports journalists or sports columnists? Because news columnists have that leeway as well,
To some extent. But we tend to separate that out into an editorial piece or an opinion piece or a column, not as a necessarily widespread journalistic practice. And just to be clear, I'm not intimating that sport journalism is less serious on news reporting, but rather that the cultural expectations surrounding it are a little bit different. And so I think if you really track the ways that sport journalism has been able to pick up on cultural change and discuss the relationships between sport and social change, that sport journalism has been a very important institution in that area.
Talk about athletic or athlete activism, Ashland, in general. What has been the tradition? Why should athletes be involved in changing social issues?
Well, I think, you know, we start to envision that athletes are somehow... that we have an ownership over them, or they're somehow separate from society because of their public role. But they're people too. They're people with families who have to live in this world and live in under the same laws as everyone else. So athletes shouldn't have to stop their activism or their, you know, their goals for social justice just because they step onto the field or because they step onto the court. So as long as they have family members who might be discriminated against or they themselves are LGBT identified, they should actually step up and do something. The more athletes that step up and do something, the least likely that they can be labeled as a distraction on the team, which is one of the worst things you could be as a distraction on the team. But we need to start seeing it as more of a responsibility. They have a platform. At a certain level, they've been groomed to be leaders, and they are able to engage a more diverse audience.
Do athletes then have an obligation to be social activists? Is it okay for them to sit on the sidelines and say nothing, even though they may believe that an issue is wrong, but they don't want to be that distraction, they don't want to get involved in it? Which side of the equation do you fall on?
I think that we should respect everyone's right to make the decisions that are in their best interest. There are times where we just don't have the laws to protect certain people. And if you coming out, for example, is going to mean that you will lose your job or you might lose your housing or you might lose your kids, I think that it's okay to make a decision not to come out because people, again, have to live in this world.
But what about alienating fans? I mean, if you're a member of a team, you want your team to have fans. And if you're taking a controversial stand on a controversial issue that may alienate fans, should you be doing that, particularly if you're a paid employee of that organization?
But there are a different subgroup of fans. If you're in one of these major cities like Atlanta, you're in one of the largest markets for LGBT people, whole different group of fan set. So it just depends on which fans you don't want to alienate and how you're making that decision. But I do believe that athletes have the right to be activists.
Yeah, I was going to make the same point. Somebody's going to be alienated. And so I think you have to decide what level of standing up for rights and inclusion are on the side of your organization's values and social justice.
So when athletes take stands, when the NBA takes a stand, when the NCAA takes a stand, Can that change people's minds?
It could change some people's minds, and it could reinforce some people's prejudices. And I'm guessing, I haven't been in the boardroom when these kinds of decisions are made, but I'm guessing that that is part of the discussion at the table, that the knowledge that some of your fan base is going to be set against you and some of your fan base could expand.
Is sports usually ahead of the curve on advancing social issues? Are they, or do they normally play catch up? And when they're playing catch up, is it because they're analyzing the bottom line?
I think it depends on the area of sport. So on issues of gender and sexual equality, in some cases, sport is way behind. And in some cases, sport is at the front edge of controversies that don't show up in other places. One really good example would be intersex athletes in the Olympics, which is a controversy that is revisited every time the Olympics come up.
Breaking the color line in 1947 was an owner decision. They hired Jackie Robinson. They made that decision. Taking a knee during the national anthem is a player decision. Pulling the NCAA, ACC, and NBA games from Charlotte is an owner decision. Or an organizational decision. Which has the most impact? And who's on the forefront? Is it the owners or is it the players?
My read is it's more typically the players.
Exactly.
Really? Are there players behind the scenes saying to the NCAA, we don't want to play in North Carolina so because of this law? Or is it the NCAA saying, we don't think our players should have to be put in a position where some of them might be discriminated against or their families might be discriminated against?
I think that's a combination of both, just by the nature of how student-athletes are treated. But when I think you get to the pro level, the professional athletes are definitely at the forefront, more so than the league.
So since the NCAA has taken games from North Carolina because of a bill they feel enshrines discrimination and because the NBA has done this as well, does that set the stage for a victory much broader than just what's happening in North Carolina? I mean, if you can't have the games here, no cities or states with anti-LGBT laws can have those games. Is that right, Ashlyn?
Yeah, absolutely. That is the standard that we have been arguing with the NBA to implement.
And so you see this as a major victory?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Ashlyn Johnson is Director of Policy and Campaigns for Athlete Ally. They work with the major sports leagues around the country with LGBT right communications. Dr. Daniel Grano, Associate Professor in the Department of Communications at UNC Charlotte. Earlier we spoke with Luke DeCock, sports columnist with the Raleigh News and Observer, and we did ask representatives from the ACC and the NCAA to join us. They could not make themselves available for the hour, but I thank you, the two of you, for your time.